Today on Maine Calling, 1 year since the Lewiston mass shooting. How have we changed? October 25th, 2023 was Maine's worst day. The day everyone feared, but no one dared imagine could happen here. A mass shooting, 18 dead, families, communities racked with grief, wrenched from loved ones. And then the questions, how could it happen? How could the system have failed so badly? How can we make sure this never happens again? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with community leaders about how the tragedy has affected the communities of the Androscoggin Valley and beyond. There are new laws, reports with recommendations, and a lawsuit. But even more importantly, the people in the Lewiston-Auburn area renewed their collective spirit to bolster each other through the grief. 1 year later, Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today marks the one-year anniversary of Maine's deadliest mass shooting. During this hour, we'll talk with leaders from Lewiston and surrounding towns about what has changed since that day and how the community is doing. This show is being streamed on Maine Public's YouTube channel and on Maine Calling's Facebook page, along with ASL Interpretation. Joining me, Shanna Cox, who is president and CEO of the Lewiston-Auburn Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce. Major Lucas Hare with the Maine State Police Operations Division. He was one of the unified commanders for the operation in Lewiston. And Jake Langlais, superintendent of Lewiston Public Schools. We invite you to join the conversation. Let us know how you were affected, what has changed for you, what your thoughts are on this one-year anniversary. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Pretty brief email, please. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you, and thank you so much for taking an hour on this day. I'm sure that there are so many emotions right now and so many people calling you and reaching out, so I doubly appreciate your time. Shanna, I remember how busy you were in the days and weeks after the shooting. You were at the epicenter of the storm as so many people reached out to your community to help, and then so many needed help. You were in the tough position of trying to figure out how to get help to those who needed it most. Bring us up to speed. Where are you now?
It's been an incredible year. I think sometimes, I don't know that it doesn't still feel in so many ways like that. There's better clarity on the storm and the busyness around us, but it still feels, particularly today as we prepare for tonight's events, pretty busy. The fundraising efforts raised $1.4 million for victims and survivors and first responders. And by mid-March, we had distributed all of those funds to those individuals, as well as to some organizations to provide emergency food service and food of comfort for the Resiliency Center and first responders. And we're incredibly proud of that work. It was intense and I think unprecedented for my team and I. We're not, chambers aren't usually direct support providers. And so we kind of got up to speed and gained some new skills, but and in doing so, just made really personal connections and relationships with people deeply impacted that day. And I think a year later, I can say we are, we're resilient and we're proud. And we're still head down, trying to focus on an economic recovery for our community and a healing recovery for our community.
Tell us, for those who might like to attend, tell us some of the details about today's event, tonight's event.
So I hope folks can join us. We're at the Colisée on Birch Street in Lewiston. There's free parking as well as parking shuttles from the Southern Parkway Gateway Garage and the Oak Street or Park Street Garage here in Lewiston. And those shuttles will be running from 4 p.m. on. The doors open at the Colisée at 6 p.m. But I think what I would really like your listeners to know is it's okay if you're not ready to join us in person, and the entire streaming experience will be on thesunjournal.com. Many networks are carrying it with commentary as well. But if you want the most true to real life experience, I'd encourage folks to go to sunjournal.com and watch the live stream, which has both closed captioning and ASL interpretation with so many of Grace's peers, who's doing a great job signing for us today. We have more than 30 interpreters in our space this evening. It's a very accessible event, no matter where you are and your relationship to wanting to attend or feeling ready to.
Jake, you have a direct view on the families and staff who are connected to the school system. What have you seen over the past year? Have your people been able to process the grief, or do those everyday demands of the school year make that really hard? Oh, you're on mute, Jake.
I think we have a bit of both. It's really hard to think that we've grieved. I think that's a long process. I'm not sure that you can get to a place where you have processed all that happened, especially in this first year where there's so many consistent reminders, from commission work and from my personal perspective, we've tried to really make sure we're not pointing anywhere. This is a terrible thing, and I think it hurts enough to not wonder where things get. Really, from a school community perspective, very challenging, but we are trying to be intentional with leading through with opportunities to grieve, opportunities to be interactive with emotions and states. For example, today we're doing drone photos at every school, and every school is doing two letters of Lewis and Strong. And just to get people outside, get them moving, standing in a letter form, having the drone go up, the kids love that. So it's trying to take what is a very somber year and a somber day, and find and create intentional opportunities to process and to engage in your emotions in a safe way, but also to realize that it's not done for any of us. I could, at least speaking for myself.
You wrote a letter that went out today, and it was called Lewiston Strong. You titled it Lewiston Strong. What does that mean to you? That phrase.
Yeah, I think when I think of Lewis and Strong, there's the thing that stimulated that Lewis and Strong piece, and I try to think of my mind almost like a deck of photos. And so the terrible night is a series of photos, but the things that happened after that, the collection of positive and the collection of good energy and great energy that came, for example, the night, the Wednesday following, when we had the Lewiston Edward Little football game and we had the details of what had happened and law enforcement served and protected us and first responders treated those that they could. We came together at Lewiston High School and we honored over 200 first responders. And, we had pictures of that and being in that moment in that space, contributions people have made. Think of things like large gatherings where we can celebrate the success and the beautiful things that are Lewis and Strong, like graduation. And the work that our kids do and really celebrating that. So trying to harness those positive photos that land in that photo deck ahead of and more quickly reached than maybe some of the ones that are not so pleasant.
Major Lucas Hare, how are you and your colleagues doing? I have to imagine that on so many levels, what happened was a law enforcement officer's worst nightmare, the thing that you have had cold sweats about all your life.
Well, I think like every community, there have been struggles to deal with what happened that night. But we also have to look at, as Jake just mentioned, the positives. Our first responders responded exactly how they were trained to and how we want them to. And by doing so, undoubtedly saved some lives. So this has been an ongoing process for the state police. This did not end when he was found. This has continued every day for us. We are daily, we work on requests for records, the investigation. We offered more than 10 hours of testimony to the commission and thousands of pages of documentation that have been made public and that were submitted to the commission. So it's really been an ongoing process that has not stopped or slowed very much for us at all.
Well, as you alluded to, there have been a lot of reports and assessments of what went right and what went wrong, including a formal after action review. What changes are now in place because of that review?
Well, the state police, and again, I will only speak for what the state police has and will continue to do. We are taking a hard look at everything that happened, trying to do it in an educated and intentional manner so that we're just continuing to move forward. We know that we, for instance, some of our managers, so our lieutenants, our sergeants, our supervisors, we need more training in recognizing any issues that our members may have had from that. So some psychological first aid training, for example, and just being able to see what if something might be bothering a member who responded or who was part of that investigation. And looking at, you know, if you look at our AAR that we submitted, I think there's a number of things in there that we've noticed or that we noted that we need to address and we're going to continue to work on in the near future.
All right. Shanna, you mentioned before the economic recovery. And yeah. You are part of the Chamber of Commerce. What did this shooting, I mean, it sounds so crass to say, but it's real life. What did this shooting mean for the economy of the Lewiston
yeah.
Auburn area?
I don't think we're done writing that story yet. I mean, to be very, very candid, the short-term impact was noticeable and quantifiable, really. I've talked to peers in other communities that have, you know, had similar incidences, and economic recovery can sometimes take 7 to 10 years. What we noted, because of the locations where the shootings happened, family entertainment, bar, restaurants, that's the sector that saw the most significant impact. And through April or May, we saw a 60% year-over-year loss. And for those businesses in that sector, that's not an operating margin that they had to work within. So we saw that be a pretty significant impact. We're proud. We helped raise about $750,000 for our small business relief fund. $680,000 of grants were deployed within 10 weeks of opening up the applications for that. And it really did help get some of our businesses through. And the vast majority were in the hospitality sector. At this point, a year later, most of them are somewhere between the 8 and 10% year-over-year loss compared to where they were last year at this time. They're seeing some recovery. The broader picture outside of our hospitality sector is we're seeing some attendances being a little bit lower for events and community events. We've seen some challenges with talent attraction. I think there's a lot of work ahead to remind people that this is a safe community, that it was safe before this day, and that this is a great place still to bring your family to work, to raise your kids. There's going to be challenges for years to come, and there's a lot of collaborative work that will need to be done between our governments, our nonprofit organizations like ours that are invested in this, and the businesses themselves. And I think it's a story that's going to have a couple more chapters in it, Jennifer, if I was to be honest.
Jake, a lot of people were talking about the spirit of Lewiston and the Lewiston-Auburn area, the whole Androscoggin Valley, and about how there was already a distinctive feeling of pride among some about how this region has such a rich history, and maybe a feeling of being looked at from the outside in a different way than people who live there feel about it. And I'm wondering if you're so good with words, if you can kind of put into words what you feel as though this tragedy has done for that spirit.
I think out of terrible situations, there's always this silver lining or bright spots that show themselves, that we're kind of always there. And I think we intuitively know it's there, but then it happens. You know, for example, by about 11:30 midnight on the night of the incident, we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 officers immediately to our community. We set up a command center at the high school, and we had people like me and our athletic director and our facilities director and our other folks chasing whatever was needed to set up that command center. And for 3 days, hundreds of folks were operating out of that space and sheltering in place and learning about communication systems and making sure we're using them well and being responsible with information. And I think when we talk about what that means to come back together, to me, it leads up to that search, that request to, okay, can we use the high school as a command center? I think we trust in our trainings and also our relationships. And the answer is absolutely. We're trying to serve the public, but there was no hesitation, I think, either way, to ask that question or to know the answer was going to be yes, working well together. So that's from a response perspective, how that tiered out was beautiful from my perspective. I'm not on a commission, so I don't know what suggestions might have been made, but I watched something happen overnight that I've never seen before. And it was really, again, in its own respects, out of something terrible, something really beautiful to see that many people who have taken a vow and an oath to go and represent and protect and to serve, to come together and use every logistical tool that they have to execute something that ultimately led to no other loss of life. So I think that's a big piece for me. But I also think that, boy, that Wednesday when we came back together as a community and we weren't in full-on crisis mode anymore the following Wednesday, which was a week later when we had the rivalry football game between Edward Little and Lewison High School. That was a pretty special night. Even the Life Flight helicopter doing a flyover and celebrities making videos. You realize the reach of your community and Lewison and where it is elsewhere in the world, all across our country and in all levels. So when we're getting the videos that are trying to cheer us up, and we have James Taylor sing the national anthem, and the Life Flight helicopter does a flyover, and we have first responders, again, hundreds of them, showing up in their formal wear, many of them. And to me, that just that level of interconnectedness, the lack of hesitation, I think, is incredibly important. But I really think that those are moments when you're like, man, I think we got this. We're going to be okay.
Major Hare, every law enforcement officer I know is a realist and for years would say that something like this could happen here. But still, I have to imagine that there is going to be a before and after in the minds of law enforcement officers all over the state, when the thing that happened other places became real. And I'm wondering if these are conversations that officers are having.
I think they are. I think that, as you said appropriately, that we as law enforcement try to prepare for that worst case scenario, and this is definitely that. And so we have trained and prepared for it, but you always hope that it wouldn't happen here. This is a relatively, or this is a great place to live, and this is not something that we had seen on this scale before. So yes, preparing for it and then dealing with it. Definitely has left some people asking those questions and working towards the future.
We are, of course, talking about the 1 year anniversary of the Lewiston shooting, the worst shooting in Maine history by far. Talking about how we've changed, what the impact is. Call and join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or find us on social media. This program is being streamed on our YouTube channel and on Maine Calling's Facebook page, along with Grace and ASL interpretation. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We mark 1 year since the massacre in Lewiston with a discussion about how the community is faring and what's changed over the past year. With me, Major Lucas Hare with the Maine State Police Operations Division. He was involved with last year's Operation Lewiston. Jake Langlais, Superintendent of Lewiston Schools, and Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the Lewiston Auburn Chamber of Commerce. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And also, we want to announce that a new podcast called Breakdown takes a closer look at what happened in Lewiston in the aftermath. The first episode dropped today, Breakdown, a 6-episode podcast produced by Maine Public, the Portland Press Herald, and Frontline PBS. Joining us now is Elizabeth Seal, who is president of Maine Hands and Voices. She is deaf. Her husband, Josh Seal, who was also deaf, was killed during the shootings in Lewiston. Liz, thank you so much for joining us. And as you sign, we will hear ASL interpretation from Grace Cooney, who is voicing for you. I'm so sorry for your loss. I can't imagine how difficult this year has been for you. How are you and your family doing a year later?
Well, if there's anything we have, we've had tremendous support from the community at large. Family, friends, the deaf community as well has been tremendous. So thus far, it's been a horribly tumultuous year, very difficult, and everybody deals with grief in a different way. But all in all, we've felt supported. And I think that's what keeps us going.
Family members like you and those who suffered, others who suffered, are suing the Army and the Department of Defense for failing to do what they could have to respond to warning signs and threats. Tell us what you and others feel about the need for this lawsuit.
Well, I feel if anything, I'm hoping that maybe they'll be able to set better protocols, mental health support, and make sure that it's really important that the needs are met and that we can help people. And, you know, and it seems like maybe the needs were not met in this case.
The deaf community was significantly affected by this. Not only four people who are deaf killed, but so many others affected. And I'm wondering, have there been positive changes in the year since? I know that at least in little ways, the answer is yes. We here today are doing this program, streaming it and signing it. Shanna talked about all of the interpreters who will be at the event tonight. Do you feel as though there's been a significant bit of progress in the amount of awareness and sensitivity to the needs of the deaf community in Maine?
Definitely, it's shown a spotlight on the deaf community and has increased awareness for the community for sure. And also questions about how to provide better access and better procedures. And I think, you know, I think that's great. Some improvement on what kind of access might need to be offered, as well as work at the state level for emergency response and access therein. So I think that we're looking forward to more progress. We definitely have goals, and it's, you know, it's not, we need to be able to get information equivalent to the hearing community. So it's so important.
And that's what I was going to ask you. What would you like to see happen next?
Much like I said, I'd like to see some sort of response system for emergency occurrences, some sort of 911 blurb that comes out, some sort of alert system, something ready for this. If this were to happen again, make sure that interpreters, captioning, everything was at the ready, and that all citizens had access to the same information.
All right. Elizabeth, I was planning to say goodbye to you at this point, but I'm wondering if you would be willing to stay with us for a little bit longer in case if any of our listeners have a question for you or a comment for you.
For sure. Sure.
All right. All right. Well, thank you so much. That is Liz Seal, who lost her husband, Josh, during the shootings last year. And she's also been one of the leaders in advocating for the families and victims of this tragedy. We'll go to Nicholas, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Nicholas. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to thank you all for having this conversation. I think it's much needed. And most importantly, to the victims and to the families, my hearts and prayers go out to everyone and the surrounding community, of course. This might come off a bit as pompous and conceited, and from the bottom of my heart, it's not intended that way. I think that active shootings have been happening for a long time, and our plan, our response has essentially remained the same. Our federal agencies and local law enforcement agencies primarily have control, and they've been able to respond accordingly, and they've been training for this for the past 20 years. And this isn't to knock the first responders. I admire what they do, and I appreciate it. But as an individual who has served on the front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan, and as an intelligence agent, I am and have a background as an expert in security, and specifically in the terrorism paradigm. And the only viable plan, in my opinion and professional experience, is for private citizens whom are following the law, which is tricky, and it gets into a gray area, specifically with the Gun Safe Act and the, you know, what forth the federal mandates. But citizens have to be prepared to respond, because, and I'll end here and let you guys pick up the conversation, the chaos that's being orchestrated when people are ambushed unsuspectingly, it's happening during the police response time. So you have to be able to defend yourself in these situations, and we need leaders who are going to actually understand that, or find people that have been through these experiences. And that's really my comment. I'd like to see us go
Nicholas,
forward.
I hear you. I don't think you're alone in feeling this way. Shana, I'll turn to you first.
Yeah. I think I don't have solutions. I do think that the solutions have to be at a policy level and bigger than individuals. I think it's a both and not an either or, Nick. I will say the thing that rocked my world, and so many others who have been leading beside me in different ways and in different response efforts over the last year, is the realization that there is a cottage industry built around mass shootings, and that the frequency and scale of impact became so clear when tip sheets were provided to me at the ready from the US Chamber, who thankfully had them, that people would arrive with mass shooting expert or consultant on their business cards. It just helps. I think so many of us go through our lives assuming that it won't happen here, and recognizing that it happens elsewhere. And every time you see it in the news, you have a response. And now that it happens to us, the response is more significant. But what I can't get away from thinking about, and I think it takes a lot more thought, is that this happens at such scale and frequency that we have set up response systems at the federal level within all kinds of funding programs, the therapeutic responses. I'm grateful that they're there, and I was grateful to have experienced peers and access to their knowledge. It is terrifying and saddening that that exists and is needed. And
Major,
that has stood out.
Yeah, that's so insightful and so I don't know, discouraging, Shana. Major Hare, I want to turn to you. I mean, Nicholas is calling for an armed citizenry. What would that mean to you on the ground, to know that people everywhere you go are armed and trying to take matters into their own hands?
Well, we as the state police, we support the law. And as long as our citizens are following the law, then we would support them. But again, he I'm not really sure that it was so much a question as he had as a statement, but that is a policy decision. And we follow the laws that our legislature sets forth for us.
All right. Nicholas, I'm going to keep you on the line for a minute, because our next caller is State Representative Vicki Dudera, who is chair of the legislature's Gun Safety Coalition. Vicki, thanks for joining us. And I do want to go to some questions about what has happened in the year since and what you hope to do next. But I'm wondering if you are able to hear Nicholas's comments and if you have thoughts about them.
Right. Hi, everybody. Thanks for asking me to participate. Yes, I did, and I also just heard Shanna's powerful words, and I'm kind of reeling from them, truthfully. You know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, in this instance, we did have some citizens who tried to respond and tried to stop a shooter, and in both locations, and they were killed for their efforts, but they very bravely did try to stop. You know, I think that prevention is also an answer in trying to, you know, prevent these tragedies from ever happening. You know, that's where we in the legislature come in. You know, we did pass, you know, many things that probably wouldn't have gotten anywhere near the traction that they got. But because of, you know, this tragedy and how it affected the whole state, we were able to make progress. So, and you know, they weren't all, you know, we think about the gun safety bills and the things that definitely affected firearms. But we also did a lot, you know, sort of to Liz Seal's point, we passed many things with regard to mental health support, you know, building new crisis receiving centers, strengthening mental health crisis intervention mobile response teams, establishing an Office of Violence Prevention, and, you know, establishing a gun shop project at firearm dealers where they'll have information on suicide and, you know, kind of coach them in recognizing the signs of things like that. And there are other things as well. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to take too much time, but I hear what Nicholas said. And I think it's important to remember we did have some people who tried in the wake of this to stop the shooter.
Yeah, and I'm going to add to this conversation. Ralph is calling in from Belgrade, also wanting to speak about guns and gun safety. Ralph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Jennifer. Yes, I'm a skeet shooter. I'm a marksman with a rifle, and I'm even a fencer at University of Maine. The black rifle needs to come off the market. We cannot have one of those in this country. It is a military weapon. It is so dangerous. Police do not like to go into a building if they know there's one there. It's got to come off. That's priority. We don't need that rifle in this country.
So Vicki, I was going to ask you what's next, and I'm wondering if this is, I believe, Ralph, when you're talking about the black rifle, are you talking about what many people refer to as assault weapons, or are you referring to something else?
Yeah, the AR-15 assault weapon, the one that the shooter used.
Okay, Vicki.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know, looking backward, we accomplished some things already, the 72-hour waiting period, expanding background checks, strengthening the route. But what Ralph is talking about, an assault weapon ban, yes, we are looking at putting forward this year sort of a version of Senator King's Go Safe law for Maine. And we are actively working on that, and that will be something that we will definitely be introducing because I agree with Ralph 100%. And I think a lot of Mainers do as well.
Liz Seal, your response to Nicholas, Ralph, and Vicki about gun safety and where we need to go next.
We never thought this would happen in our beautiful state of Maine, but it did. And focusing on prevention and training is imperative, but we have to think he made it to two locations. And usually you think of a mass shooting happening in a single place, for him to go to two, the chaos it caused, I don't think anybody could have planned for that. And we're all, of course, learning how best to prevent these kinds of things and how to best respond afterwards.
All right, well, Liz Seal, thank you. Vicki Dudera, Maine State Representative from Camden, thank you so much for calling. And also to Nicholas from Bangor and Ralph in Belgrade, for bringing up this part of the conversation. We do need to take another quick break. Today's program is streaming live on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Public's Facebook page. We have ASL interpretation from Grace Cooney. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. The terrible events of Lewiston 1 year ago have had many repercussions. Today, we're discussing those. Joining me, Jake Langless with the Lewiston Public Schools, Shanna Cox with the Lewiston Auburn Chamber of Commerce, and Major Lucas Hare with Maine State Police. You can join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. And be sure to check out the new 6-part podcast, Breakdown, which is presented by Maine Public, the Portland Press Herald, and Frontline PBS. It delves into how and why the tragic events in Lewiston occurred and about how everyone has been affected by them. Again, the first part just dropped this morning on Maine Public's Facebook page. On the webpage, you can find it at mainepublic.org. Shanna, there's been talk of some kind of memorial. Where is that, and what might it look like?
Well, there's not a physical location yet, Jen. I appreciate the question. I think pretty quickly, we recognize the importance of establishing a permanent memorial, and the One Lewiston Resilience Fund and its committee was established. The committee's job is to both help plan the engagement around and the completion of the memorial and to steward the funds and donations for that effort. And what we've learned is that it can take 7, 10, 12 years to establish memorials at some of these locations. And when it's done well, and that the memorial truly serves the purpose of healing for a community, it's done with intention and care. And the planning of it is one that involves a lot of engagement with the variety of impacted communities. And so at this point, we've recognized some of the key elements that are often found in a memorial. Those include arts and culture, outdoor elements and nature, education. We haven't begun to talk about a site or a location. That's really going to be driven by what we hear through engagement processes that are going to kick off in January and run throughout all of 2025. We expect that that'll end in some renderings and some architectural landscape drawings. And that'll lead to another round of engagement that helps us start to really hone in and finalize what does this need to mean to people? What would it have to look like and feel like to have the goal of healing? We know remembrance is just one component of what a permanent memorial will do. And so I have dealt with so many questions over the last year of why isn't it up yet? Or when is it going to be done? And I just keep reminding folks that we're going to move at the pace of trust and healing and engagement. And I think that it's going to be meaningful. The committee likes to say that the process of planning the memorial is as healing as the memorial itself. And that's exactly where we're at right now. It starts with tonight's event, honestly. Yeah.
Liz Seal, as someone who lost a loved one, do you feel as though a memorial is important? And if so, what do you hope it does?
Absolutely. I think it'll be amazing. A place for people to go, to visit, to talk with those loved ones that they lost, to remember, to share stories. I think it's imperative for the community. And I'm looking forward to it being established. And I understand it will take a while. And it takes a long time to think through the whole process and make sure that it's just right before you implement it, because you really don't want to set something up and then it not match the needs and the vision of everybody. You want everybody to feel that they love it.
And Jake, what are your thoughts on what a memorial might need to do, a permanent memorial?
I mean, I think that it's critically important. I would also like to echo what Shanna said about the process and the involvement. I think so often, we're fortunate because all of our kids come to the place every day at school. But, you know, when we did things like we mentioned this morning, the intentionality of, you know, shooting drone photos with kids doing Lewis and Strong spelled out, but it was also about getting out in the open, breathing the fresh air, being intentional on a day that's really tough, having community, doing something that's bigger than yourself, and having some kind of way to capture that, I think is all incredibly important. but every major event in our society has a someplace where you can go. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't say thank you to the folks at places like the Maine Mill that's done a lot of good work to capture the history of this, but also to memorialize it, I think is very important. And for me, deeply meaningful to know that there's a spot. I think that there's also, and I don't want to get ahead of myself or my own emotions or grieving process, but there's a sense of closure when you've worked through a thing. Kind of logistically, and then establish a something like a memorial. I think it allows you to visit something, but not live it every day. And I say that in the utmost respect for folks who have suffered great loss from this tragedy.
Representative Vicky Dudera is back with us, but Vicky, I'm going to first go to Larry from St. Andrews in New Brunswick, Canada. Hi, Larry, go ahead.
Hi. I had wondered about this question of gun laws, and I was interested to hear the gentleman from Belfast say that AR-15s are a key question with this. And I'm just wondering how this all comports with the Second Amendment, which a lot of the people who are in favor of very relaxed or no gun laws at all, they quote the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. What are the implications of this shooting for the gun laws, and what should we be doing or trying to do, both at a state level and at a national level, to try to really raise the question of how important the gun laws are and whether we want our society to be known for a place in which guns may be misused in terrible ways?
Larry, you've asked a really big question. But I'm going to turn to Vicky Dudera because this is something she studies a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for calling in, Larry. Yeah, I hear you. And of course, that's the endless debate. We do have the Second Amendment. Those of us, working in this arena in the legislature of gun safety, we recognize that. We appreciate it. Nonetheless, we also have a duty to keep people safe in our state and promote public health. And court cases have shown that that is not incompatible with also having a Second Amendment. So, going forward, we'll be looking at other arenas that are, that are obstacles for public safety in our state. We're looking at the growing proliferation of ghost guns and what we need to do about that. We're looking at our high rate of suicide and more things we couldn't put in place to help with that. But, gun violence is preventable, and recognizing that we have a Second Amendment, that we have a rich tradition of hunting, does not have to be, opposed to that. We can have both.
Larry, thank you. We're going to go to Tom, who's from Freeport. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. I got to say, sorry to the ones doing the show with you and lost her husband, I guess, out of the gate. But I really feel there should be an app for when there's something going down. I made the first bike rack that went into the back of a car back in the 80s. Never did anything about it. My daughter and I designed Uber before there was Uber. Never did anything about it. What about an app that if somebody's around, that certainly something to, it could be at least let people know, don't go there. Or if you're there,
sure.
Leave. Or
sure.
If you happen to have...
Tom, I wanted to have you ask that question while Representative Dudera is on the phone. Vicky, we are making progress in maybe not an app, but tell us what's happened.
Yes, I have to say I don't have the details, but we did direct the Commissioner of Public Safety to develop and implement procedures to notify the public in active shooter situations. So unfortunately, I don't have the exact details on how that's happening, but the concerns that Liz Seal raised earlier and what this gentleman is saying, that is something that we're going to be instituting if it's not already out there.
Better notification.
Right, exactly. In active shooter situations, yeah.
Well, Representative Vicky Dudera, thank you. Tom calling in from Freeport, thank you. Let's see here. We will go to Michelle, who's calling from Cornish. Hi, Michelle, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say that all of the callers have been great, and I wanted to see if you could update everybody on what has happened with the people who knew that this individual in this particular situation was extremely threatening and dangerous, like the military. I just think that if we're going to talk prevention, that I think something more should have been done to prevent this by people that knew he was a dangerous individual.
Yeah, Michelle, and I think you've touched on something that so many people are investigating. Elizabeth Seal, this is at the heart of your lawsuit, right?
It is. I think most importantly, it was a communication breakdown. The agencies involved that were supposed to be communicating with each other and focusing on setting up protocol and policy, something a little more clear-cut and easy to follow, I think that would be a great improvement from what we have.
Michelle, thanks for your call. We'll move on to South Portland and James. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Last year, I testified in front of the committee that was considering Maine's red flag bill, which unfortunately did not pass. And I wanted to kind of share my personal experience with Maine's yellow flag law and its failure in this sense. I lost my brother to suicide by gun, which a red flag law may have helped me prevent. But Maine's yellow flag law was insufficient to deal with that. And it could have been so much worse. That was actually the best case scenario. My brother was bipolar, schizophrenic, but was still allowed to purchase weapons and a considerable amount of ammunition. He was stockpiling this during the COVID pandemic. He would often call me when he was bipolar, and he just had a lot of paranoia about what was not only going on in the world, but very similar to the shooter in Lewiston, he had paranoid ideations that people were spreading rumors about him at the local grocery store, at the local bar. And he had the means to go to those places with his weapons and do a mass shooting. Like I said, fortunately, he took his own life instead of taking other people's lives. But Maine's yellow flag law was ineffective in helping to stop him, mostly because as a family member who was aware of his mental situation, it really didn't protect me or my family if it wasn't able to remove his guns, deal with him in a safe way where he couldn't get his guns back quickly and, you know, in his mental state enact retribution. I also think that's a big reason why a lot of psychiatrists and doctors will not get involved with the yellow flag law, where a red flag law would allow them to take action and be protected.
James, thank you for calling in, and I'm so sorry for the loss of your brother and what your family has gone through. No one who's on our panel today is in a position of changing policy on a statewide level. But Major Hare, I'll turn to you and say that since the shooting, Maine's yellow flag law has been implemented much more often than before. It was fairly new when this happened. And I'm wondering if you believe there has been a real, just an increase among law enforcement in what the yellow flag law can do and readiness to use it.
Well, again, I think you said it. We're sorry for your loss, and there is no one here that makes policy. But yes, I think that the state police has implemented that law the most of any agency within the state. Will continue to use it when appropriate. It is a tool that is effective when used under the guidelines we've been given. So has it become, I think, that the behavioral health issues that we're seeing in our state has now been a forefront for everyone, not just the police, but you're seeing it across a wide spectrum of providers, whether it's clinicians, first responders, our hospitals and our other institutions. So yes, I think this has very much become an issue that we are all dealing with or is at the forefront of what we're doing every day.
James, thank you for your call, and it will be the last call this hour. I really appreciate all of you joining us for the hour. The voice you just heard, Major Lucas Hare with the Maine State Police's Operations Division, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the Lewiston-Auburn Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, Jake Langless, the Superintendent of Lewiston Public Schools, and also with us, Elizabeth Seal, President of Maine Hands and Voices. She lost her husband, Josh, during the shootings last year and is now an advocate for the families. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. We had help from Nick Godfrey and Nick Woodward. And we want to thank Allison Grace Cooney, our ASL interpreter, who is with MJ Interpreter. Our theme song, Mike Jandro composed it. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.